Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of a May 23rd New York Times Magazine cover story, Marcela Valdez. In this story, she focuses on Arizona. The article is titled, Is It Possible to Resist Deportation in Trump's America? Living under draconian state laws, Arizona activists honed an effective strategy for keeping undocumented immigrants in the country. Can the same tools still work today? She tells stories about undocumented immigrants being deported, and she starts with the first person deported under President Trump's new executive orders on immigration, efforts to stop deportations, and some interesting material on how presidents have handled deportation, with an emphasis on Presidents Obama, Clinton, and Eisenhower. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Marcela, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, it was a great, thorough article. Why don't you start, because these stories really tug at your heart, with February 6th, the first person deported under President Trump's new executive orders on immigration. It tells us a great deal about the people who have come here and what's happening right now in terms of deportation.
Right, so that was a case that got a fair amount of attention when it happened in February. The case revolved around a woman named Guadalupe Garcia Aguilar. In most press reports, however, her name was listed as Garcia de Rayos because that was the name that ICE had booked her under, although it's not her legal name. Garcia Aguilar had moved to the United States when she was 14 years old. She'd lived here for 16 years. She was the mother of two American citizens, and she had just missed being eligible for DACA by a few months. In 2008, she was caught in a raid on the business that she worked, where she worked, called Golfland Sunsplash. It's an amusement park in Mesa, Arizona. And she was arrested for, or charged later on with, for working with under a fabricated social security number. In 2000, she spent 3 months in jail, 3 months in detention, and then in 2013, an immigration court ordered her removal. Yet, under some pressure from a group of undocumented immigrants called Puente, which held a press conference and drew attention to her case, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, actually used prosecutorial discretion to allow her to stay in Arizona under something that's called an order of supervision. It's basically like a kind of parole for immigrants. So she stayed in Arizona, checking in once a year. One of the reasons why ICE could stay her removal was because under the Obama administration, the ICE had set priorities for terrorist and violent criminals, and Garcia Aguilar was neither of those. She had no history of breaking the law except for entering the United States illegally and for using this fabricated social security number to work. But all that changed under President Trump. So one of the first things that President Trump did when he came into office on January 25th, he signed a pair of executive orders related to immigration and immigration enforcement. And one of the things that happened in those orders is that they vacated the priorities set by, essentially vacated the priorities set by Obama administration. And in fact, one of the orders specifically said that people who had been ordered for deportation should be promptly removed, like Garcia Aguilar had been ordered to be removed in 2013. So at the beginning of February, she showed up for her annual check-in with ICE. And again, the same organization held like a sidewalk press conference to draw attention to her case. And again, she walked into ICE with her lawyer. And this time, she did not come out. This time, ICE held her, and the lawyer tried to file a stay for her deportation again, and the protesters and her supporters stayed around ICE for most of the day. In the afternoon, some of them left, but they came back in the evening for a candlelight vigil. And that night, after dark, ICE sent out several vans through a side exit. And some of the activists stopped the vans using their bodies. And several of them stopped the van that Garcia Aguilar was in. In fact, an Army veteran basically sat down by the driver's front wheel and wrapped his arms and legs around the wheel to prevent the van from moving forward anymore. And then protesters surrounded it and a chanting sort of picket line. And news, cable news, and everyone began drawing attention to it, and attention to the case happened over Facebook and Twitter. And eventually that van went back into ICE, and the protesters were dispersed by the police. But later that night, she was still taken out of the ICE headquarters and taken to Nogales, Mexico. So she was deported.
Mm-hmm. So you say that she had three choices, that she could appoint, she could be there for her appointment as she was supposed to be in, which is what she did. She could try to hide, or she could put up a fight from a place of sanctuary. Did she seriously consider any of the other possibilities, and what would have been her chances of staying if she had done one of the latter?
I spoke with her husband about this, and he said that they did consider the other possibilities, but they're a very religious family, and they did not ethically like the idea of being on the lam from the law.
Mm-hmm.
They felt like that was not the course that they would want to take, and they also felt like it wasn't, in his words, he said to me, no es vida, it's not a life, you know, to be running from the law. And then in terms of sanctuary, I mean, one of the things that people often forget about sanctuary is that it is, in effect, like a kind of jail.
Right.
I mean, you may be in a church, but you are staying in the church all the time. You're still, in a way, in a kind of prison of walls. And so that did not appeal to them either. And when they had had the sidewalk press conference back in 2013, it had been successful. And so they had the experience of doing not the kind of protest action around the van, but the kind of attention on the sidewalk with a great group of supporters and some news coverage. And that had worked, so they thought that they would try that again.
Mm-hmm. What happened to her children?
Well, her children are American citizens. So they are still here in the United States. And, in fact, they've become sort of celebrities within the undocumented rights movement. The same month that their mother was deported, they sat in the audience of Trump's first address to Congress. They were the guests of two Democratic representatives from Arizona. And they're still active in the organization Puente and still active in advocating for their mother's return to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to her? When you go to Nogales, what happens to you?
So I wasn't with her in Nogales, but what I have heard is that basically when she arrived there, the director of this organization, Puente, Carlos Garcia, had already driven down to Nogales to meet her there. So he's a legal American resident, and so he went down there, and they held another press conference for her there. And at that point, she'd kind of become a celebrity, and there were people sort of stalking her outside of her hotel and wanting to take pictures. It was a little overwhelming for the family, so they quickly left Nogales so that she could say a proper goodbye to her children. And then she got on a plane, and she flew to her hometown, and that's where she is now.
Mm-hmm. You write about Puente, this organization that's working with these cases, having a hand in stopping about 300 deportations in Arizona since 2012. What tactics were most successful that they used, and why didn't they work in her case, and have they been successful in recent cases?
Mm. So Puente is an organization that has been around since 2007, and they have used just about every tactic that you can think of, from marches and boycotts, Twitter campaigns, Facebook campaigns, attending city council meetings. They have So it's hard to say just one tactic they used. They've basically used everything. But one of the things they have found most effective is this strategy that they use called the Neighborhood Defense Committees. And what this was is they began this in around 2012 as they started to form groups in different neighborhoods to bring undocumented people together to talk about what was happening in their lives and what was happening in their cases. And in this way, they built relationships with vulnerable people that lasted far beyond any sort of march. And these people then often turned out with each other for public events. And those public events, such as rallies or marches or call-in campaigns or letter campaigns, were often effective under the Obama administration because the Obama administration had a rhetoric that was very pro-immigrant. And so drawing attention to cases of deportation seemed to create a moral dilemma, as one activist said to me, and that would make them push ICE, or we're assuming they were pushing ICE, but would lead ICE to use prosecutorial discretion in order to stop a deportation. But even under Obama, it's important to note those strategies stopped working in 2014. So it wasn't just a shift with the Trump administration. For these activists, they see this as a fight that they've really been fighting for many, many years, and especially since 2014.
Mm-hmm. Let's just talk, as long as you brought up the many, many years. You have a very interesting part of the article where you talk about what has happened in terms of our need for this kind of labor in the country at a certain point in our history, what happened during the Eisenhower administration, the Clinton administration, and the Obama administration. When did we need people who were undocumented? We needed them for our workforce. And how did the economics change the whole immigration picture?
Gosh, I mean, when did we begin needing undocumented immigrants? I mean, we have to remember that parts of the United States actually belong to Mexico at
right.
this point. So, and there's a lot of history written about how many of those people, once they became part of the United States, were actually deprived of their land. So, I mean, it's hard to trace the beginning of it, but in recent history, we can definitely talk about how in the Roaring Twenties, there was a big influx of labor from Mexico. So when all this booming businesses happened, and then when the Great Depression happened, at least 1 million Mexican nationals and Mexican Americans were forcibly repatriated. Mm. And then during the beginning in the 1940s, some 4.6 million Mexicans were imported into the United States, mostly to work in agricultural fields. Now, that's a program that kept going for several decades, that even overlapped with a program in the 1950s that happened under President Eisenhower's administration called Operation Wetback, which then deported, even as we were importing labor for the agricultural fields, we were deporting 1 million Mexicans by truck, train, and ship under Operation Wetback. So I think that it's fair to say that for all of our history, the United States has really had a love-hate relationship with particularly Spanish-speaking labor, although similar things could be said of Asian labor, Chinese labor. So Asian Americans also have a very large population of undocumented residents in the United States. So, and we could talk about, you know, Gold Rush in California related to that, too.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little more about what's going on in Arizona. Arizona passed, tell me when, Senate Bill 1070, one of the toughest anti-undocumented bills ever signed into law.
Yes, they passed that, and SB 1070 was passed in 2010, and it was indeed at that time the toughest anti-immigration undocumented bill signed into law. It was later surpassed by HB 56 from Alabama. And one of the things that was most serious about that law was that it gave police officers, Arizona police officers, an obligation to question anyone who they suspected of being undocumented. That was known as the Papers, Please Law. And that is actually still in effect. So there are some other measures in the Arizona law, SB 1070, that were later overturned by courts, but the Papers, Please law is still in effect.
And yet there were Puente, and I'm sure other organizations, advised people how you could respond to being stopped. What was in your constitutional power?
Right. So in their Know Your Rights classes, they taught people that if a police officer pulled them over while they were driving, they could exercise their constitutional right to remain silent while they were being questioned. And they could say if they were stopped in their car, they could walk away from the car unless the officer was explicitly detaining them. Or just like any other American, if the police come to your home and they want you to come in, you can ask them to show you a warrant that they are allowed to come into your home. And undocumented residents have those rights as well, and Puente to help teach them those rights. None of those rights, mind you, would help them if they were actually caught by ICE and fingerprinted and tracked and found out they were leaving here without legal authorization. But they're the rights to not be sort of to due process in some ways, and also to make sure that the police officers are following the law and not detaining someone that they don't haven't explicitly detained or mm-hmm. entered homes without authorization.
And before we go to phone calls, also explain this 287G agreement that Maricopa County has with ICE. Law enforcement agencies have a whole lot of powers to put people in jail.
Oh, yeah. So this is a very interesting kind of agreement. It was a 287G agreement actually began under the Bush administration, but it really took off during the Obama administration. The 287G agreement is an agreement between ICE and local police departments that can give local law enforcement the power to initiate deportation proceedings inside jails or to assemble task forces to arrest people suspected of being undocumented while out on patrol. In Arizona, under Sheriff Arpaio, there was definitely abuse that happened of this law. He used his task force to conduct crime suppression sweeps, in what he called crime suppression sweeps, in which police would just detain anyone who they wanted for minor offenses like honking a horn and then demand the proof of legal residence. And that part of his 287G agreement was actually revoked in 2009. Under Obama, the 287G agreements skyrocketed. So when he, in 2006, ICE only had about $5 million to implement these agreements. And a year into Obama's first term, that number had gone up to $68 million. So from $5 million to $68 million wow. going into this agreement. Mm-hmm. And then later that dropped to $24 million.
And in the Trump campaign, he talked a whole lot about this issue, but he specifically mentioned gang members, drug dealers, and others who needed to be removed. Obviously, the woman you outlined some time ago was none of those. I'm wondering, in the Obama administration, were drug dealers and gang members those who were targeted? Because it looks like there were a huge number of deportations, and if indeed this case of a mother of two children who had a phony Social Security card is an aberration, or if we're beginning to see a deportation of people who are not hardened criminals.
So I guess a couple points there. The Obama administration did set sort of gang members and terrorists as priorities. Under the Trump administration, essentially every undocumented immigrant is a priority. That's problematic for reasons that we could get into. But under Obama, we have to remember that Garcia Aguilar was initially picked up during the Obama administration. She was picked up in 2008 on a raid on her business, and her deportation was ordered in 2013 when Obama was in power also. And she would have been deported if it had not been for the public actions of a group like Puente. So mm-hmm. the real shift from the Obama administration to the Trump administration is that when activists drew attention to cases where the person who was going to be deported was not a gang member and was not a terrorist, then they had the hope of this use of prosecutorial discretion to stop the deportation. And under the Trump administration, the hope that prosecutorial discretion could be used to stop a deportation case from proceeding all the way to actual deportation has really evaporated.
Mm-hmm. And do we have any idea, Marcella, how many people are being deported who are in situations similar to Garcia? Do we have hard numbers on that?
We don't have hard numbers right now on exactly how many people have been deported who are not criminals, but nationally we do know that ICE's non-criminal arrests have increased by 157%.
Wow.
So that's an increase of 157%, right? So it's more than twice the number that it was compared to the first 4 months of 2016. And so if it's a non-criminal arrest, it means that a person has committed no crime except for the crime of being in the United States without papers.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest who wrote the New York Times cover story May 23rd. Is it possible to resist deportation in Trump's America? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Does it make sense for us to target gang members, drug dealers, and other, or gang members and drug dealers? What about all the others? And there are many of them who are being removed. What's the overall aim in this administration? What was it in the Obama administration? What do you think of what's happening in this regard? We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. And I know many of you have thoughts on this, so give us a ring. 800-486-8655. We'll start taking your calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Immigration, what should our policy be? What do you make of these stories of people who are being deported, who have children who are here, breaking up families? Does it make sense to do that because they are undocumented workers? What about all the paths that we've had when it comes to immigration, people who are here undocumented? And what do you make of the resistance to this? Do you think that actually the story hasn't been receiving a whole lot of attention recently because there are a lot of other things going on, but should it be receiving more attention? What is, do you think, I keep wondering if there was any policy that could be articulated by any of these administrations as to what the ultimate goal is now. Is the Trump administration's goal to keep anybody from Central America coming into the United States who is undocumented? Is that the point they're making with these kinds of deportations? What was the Obama administration's overriding goal here? Do we have an overriding goal, Marcella?
Yeah, I mean, the Trump administration, not in his campaign, but as official government statements, has been careful to not say that the deportations are necessarily of a specific ethnic group, right? So in his campaign rhetoric, there was a lot of discussion, particularly about Mexicans, but as an administrative policy, that has not been articulated. Under Obama, the discussion was felons, not families. That was a statement of saying that they were going to be deporting anyone who was a criminal, anyone who was a gang member or dangerous to society, but they were going to do their best to leave in place. For example, undocumented people who were brought to the United States as minors, that was the DACA program, and also parents of those undocumented minors or parents of American citizens who were not lawbreakers aside from entering the country. That was the DAPA program, which actually never was implemented. So that became a bit more controversial, that extension of it. But the Trump administration did deport more people than any other presidential administration in American history. So there was also a very aggressive campaign of deportations happening. Many of them were actually stopped at the border of people being turned back. I think the Trump administration is working now more in internal deportations than the Trump administration, than the Obama administration did.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we have some lines open for you right now. Mike in Twin Lakes is first. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'm one of these people probably they're not going to like to hear from, but I've had enough. These people are not undocumented. They're illegal. And especially this woman that they deported, it's a shame. But she had 14 years to become a citizen. She knew she was what she was doing was illegal. And on top of it, she made up a false Social Security number indicating she knew it. And this is actually an insult to all the Mexican-American or Spanish-Americans who've come here and done it legally. My grandfather was an immigrant, and he became a citizen. Now, it's time, you know, they're saying only the illegal, the ones breaking the law. They are breaking the law. They need to be citizens. And like I said, they've known about it, and when they come over, they know that. I don't have any sympathy for them.
But, Mike, she came over when she was the first case we were talking about, when she was 14 years old.
Yeah, and she had how many years to become a citizen? And rather than do that, she decided to make up a false Social Security number. How many years could she have tried to get her citizenship? Instead, by getting that Social Security number, she hid. She hid from it and didn't care to.
Marcella.
Well, definitely she broke the law entering the United States. I don't disagree with that at all. In terms of using the term illegal immigrants is a legal term. I don't mind when people use it. I personally don't choose to use it because I feel like if we speak of illegal immigrants, we should also speak of illegal businesses that hire them and give them work and then underbid their competitors by using them. We should speak of illegal employers who hire undocumented people to clean their gardens and watch their children and do all sorts of other manual labor for them. So it seems to me a little bit hard to speak only of the illegal immigrants and not of all the other people who are involved in their existence and benefit from their existence in the United States. As to 14 years to become a citizen, in fact, there are pretty rigorous processes for becoming a citizen, and if you have entered the country without proper authorization, there is no clear process for you to become a citizen. In fact, you would be banned from the United States for 10 years. So it's not a matter of she didn't choose to do it. Currently, there is no process for that right now. I'm very struck by the comment about the immigrant grandfather. So one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that immigration laws in the United States have changed drastically since our grandparents' time. It's true that I think, I'm not quite sure what the statistic is. I don't want to just throw something out there. But there's a tremendous number of Americans here today who have an immigrant grandfather or grandmother. Our president has an immigrant mother. But immigration laws have changed drastically from the days when people just had to go through Ellis Island and get a sort of health check and then be allowed into the country. It is much, much more difficult to be allowed in the United States today than it was at the turn of the century. And I do believe that that influx of immigrants that happened in the late 1800s and the early 1900s is part of what made us such a tremendously powerful country in the 20th century, and that people like this caller here who are descendants of immigrants are fantastic Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you have, you juxtapose what's going on in the stories that you write about with somebody who's paying $500,000 to get a visa if you invest money in somebody's housing development. I mean, there are so many irregularities, and it seems as though if you have a lot of money, you can get around all of this.
I mean, I do think that the United States has a right to, I do not believe in an open border. I do believe that the United States is a sovereign country, has a border, has a right to regulate its border. But I also think that sometimes when we enter this discussion, we lose sight of what the actual laws and obstacles are and the reasons why people are coming to this country, mm-hmm, in the first place.
And also the human misery that results when this kind of action is taken, not only for Garcia, but certainly for her children and her husband and for the rest of her life. You have to wonder, isn't there a better way to do this?
Yes, I do think that people tend to focus on that part of the equation, and I am sympathetic to that part of the equation. But for me personally, I find the structural things more moving because we know that human misery hits many families in many forms. Undocumented immigrants don't have a monopoly on it. But I do think that many people are not really quite aware of or maybe in a little bit of a denial of how much in so many parts of the country our economy actually depends on this labor force. I mean, farmers in California and Ohio are worried that they will not get enough migrant workers to come to their fields this summer. And if that happens, if the migrants don't show up, I think we can expect reasonably food prices to go up for all Americans.
Well, that's an interesting part of your story, too, because there have been times when we've needed this kind of labor. We look at the housing boom, and then we look at what happened with the housing burst in 2007 when we needed all these immigrants for a while to come and do all of this work and building homes. And then when the other thing happened, oh, we don't need you anymore. You have to go back. Well, it's either feast or famine for people who are doing this kind of work.
Yes, I think that that's definitely true. I don't think it's a coincidence that Sheriff Arpaio applied for and gained the 287 agreement in 2007, which was at the late that year, was the beginning of Arizona's housing bust. And in 2008, Arizona had 117,000 foreclosures. It was the third highest number of foreclosures in the country. That had a devastating economic freefall. And, you know, immigrants, and especially undocumented immigrants, could become a sort of a scapegoat for that economic freefall and a feeling like, no, now we don't have enough for you to be here.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We are speaking this hour of the program with the author of a piece in the New York Times. It was on May 23rd. Is it possible to resist deportation in Trump's America? Living under draconian state laws, Arizona activists honed an effective strategy for keeping undocumented immigrants in the country. Can the same tools still work today? Marcela Valdez is our guest, and we certainly welcome your thoughts about this. What should our policy be? We've given you an outline of what has been in the history, but also how those who are undocumented are so woven into the American economy that what about how it will hurt business to deport many of these workers? We have an email from someone who works on a dairy farm. The farm has a Spanish translator, this person says, the listener. The translator said there is no fear of deportation. The worst case for them is a couple of days in jail and a fine. This person believes that the president is trying to paint any person of color as a criminal to appeal to his base. Marcela, what do you say?
I think it depends about whether somebody just spends a couple days in jail and receives a fine. Depends a lot on where that dairy farm is located and also who's in charge of that particular police department and who's in charge of that particular local ICE office, field office. I mean, one of the things that has happened under President Trump is when he vacated essentially vacated Obama's priorities and made everyone a priority, what many lawyers have explained to me is that essentially means that there's no priority because you can't possibly pick up everyone unless you're doing mass roundups. And so what's happening is that the decision As a former chief counsel to the United States Citizen and Immigration Services explained to me, the decision of who to prioritize is now left in the hands of every individual ICE agent and every individual Border Patrol officer and every individual police officer under a 287G agreement. And so it's possible that the people were running the police department or the immigration field office near that dairy farm have decided that the local community needs those undocumented people to do necessary labor.
That's interesting.
And so therefore are letting them go. And so there's definitely this big tapestry of variation in what enforcement can look like from location to location.
Hmm. I wonder if that means that people are starting to move to certain parts of the country where they feel they can be safer.
I definitely heard anecdotal accounts that that was happening. I don't have any hard numbers on that, but it's probably beginning to emerge about this time of year. So a longtime immigration rights advocate in Arizona explained to me that when SB 1070 first passed in 2010, a lot of the undocumented immigrants waited until the end of the school year before they moved because they wanted their children to be able to finish school. And so, and then so more of the moves happened over the summer. And now we're at summertime. So I think in fall, when we see shifts in the numbers of students registered in different school districts, we may have a better sense of how many people have moved or simply tried to go underground.
Teresa in Lodi, our next caller. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I was just, this very interesting topic to me. My husband entered the country undocumented from Mexico, entered without inspection, they call it, 20 years ago, and we have taken the last 15 years to get his citizenship going through an extreme hardship waiver process, with him being voluntarily deported, and he will be getting his citizenship on July 13th. But for those people out there who think that you just get in line and wait your turn, there is no such thing. It was a long, painful process.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was quite expensive as well.
It's quite expensive, extremely expensive.
And give me a better indication, Teresa, of what happens during the process, why it took 15 years.
So first, when we first applied or thought or we started seeing an attorney thinking we were going to go through this process, we were told there was no way to actually do it. And then as we saw more attorneys, and years can go by and we're spending thousands of dollars, there was no way that he would be allowed to stay here to apply for his citizenship. So you apply for a visa and then they deny you. And then when you're denied, they schedule you an appointment in Mexico, in Juarez, Mexico, one of the murder capitals of the world, which was a bad thing in itself. But and then you have to go there. And then when they deny you your visa, then you have to apply for an extreme hardship waiver. And then you have to wait until they make an appointment for you for your extreme hardship waiver. And then you go and you plead your case. And then you have to wait a certain number of years before you can apply for citizenship.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's very bittersweet when we have, to me, in our government, the most racist, I'm not even sure how to describe them. It feels very bittersweet at this point that he's finally going to get his citizenship under this administration.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't make a difference. And what are the rules here, Marcella, when you marry somebody from a different country? You still have to go through this laborious process, Marcella?
Well, if you're undocumented, that's a mark against your citizenship application. And so it's not so quite so simple as just marrying someone if you've already broken the law. I mean, that I think people tend to be, as this caller is explaining very movingly, when people are in the country and they are undocumented, it is often a long, painful, difficult, and extremely expensive process to become a citizen. This is what people refer to partly when they speak of our broken immigration system, is how difficult this process can be.
Mm. So
I add one more thing?
Of course.
The people who have the fake Social Security numbers, those people are paying taxes and they're paying in. There are billions and billions of unclaimed dollars in Social Security that will never be claimed because just as my husband did, you pay in your taxes, you pay in your Social Security, and you're never eligible to receive any of it back. There's statistics on it, how many billions of dollars of unclaimed money are sent in by undocumented immigrants. The people who think that, you know, they just come here and live off the United States citizens or whatever their thought process is, I know lots of undocumented immigrants. They work very hard. It's very difficult to find farm workers, someone to milk cows. My husband did all those jobs. Mm-hmm. And I have no, people are going to be shocked as the deportations continue, and we don't have anyone to do those jobs.
Marcella.
So in a previous article that I worked on for the New York Times Magazine, I was focusing on reporting in Virginia, which has, and particularly in a county in Virginia called Prince Williams County in Virginia, and which passed, got a 287G agreement for its police officers and passed something known in its county. County Board of Supervisors passed something called Immigration Resolution that was essentially a sort of SB 1070 for Prince Williams County. And what happened was the undocumented immigrants fled. And the economy in Prince George's, I mean, this is right about the time of the collapse of the housing market, mm-hmm. but economists from the University of Virginia have calculated that passing this law actually exacerbated the economic woes of Prince William County because people left. They abandoned homes. Mm. Businesses didn't realize how many people were coming in. When people left, they took their families with them. They took their children with them. These were people who were buying gas at the gas station, food at the grocery store, using all sorts of services that help support local economies. And I do believe that if everyone were to disappear, if everyone were to be sent away, then we would actually learn the real contributions that undocumented people are making to everyone's daily life, whether or not they realize it or not.
Thanks, Teresa, so much. All the best to your husband as he becomes an American citizen. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is the author of a very thorough piece, an interesting piece in the New York Times Magazine in May, Learning Several Ways, well, it's about deportations, and it is titled, Is It Possible to Resist Deportation in Trump's America? Living under draconian state laws, Arizona activists honed an effective strategy for keeping undocumented immigrants in the country. Can the same tools still work today? And I guess the question we need answered as we continue is, why in the world can't we come up with some kind of humane, sensible immigration system in this country? What's so politically sensitive about all of this? Why don't we do this? What do you think? We'll take more phone calls and continue with Marcella Valdez in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Why is it that we can't, Marcella, figure this out? Why is it that it's been a long time since we've looked at immigration in this issue and found a system that's fair to people and good for the economy and good for America? Why can't we do that?
Yeah, it's definitely a very emotional issue for many people on both sides of it. I think that much of the conflict has to do with, around this issue, has to do with the differing opinions we have about how serious or how damaging it is to break the law by entering the country without legal authorization. I mean, some people see this as a serious criminal infraction. Mm-hmm. And others, people see it more like, you know, using a friend's address to register your child into a better school district. You know, that's also breaking the law, but maybe in some people's eyes, not so serious. And the debate has become increasingly polarized between those who believe that every single illegal immigrant should be removed and those who believe that every single undocumented person should be allowed to stay. And the reasonable solution is probably somewhere in between that, but it's become nearly impossible to have any sort of well-informed conversation about why so many undocumented immigrants live in the United States and what roles they really play in our economy and in our civic culture. And without that kind of conversation, I have very little hope that we will ever pass an effective, reasonable legislation.
Let's go to Nick in La Crosse. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. Say, I'm a strong Republican, all right? I'm a son of the baby boomers. But I want to tell you, this woman that's on the radio today is the first time I have heard, and I'm just guessing, but I think I'm right. Probably pretty much Democratic and a little...
She's a reporter for the New York Times, so...
But anyway, she is not jumping over things that she don't know, and I really enjoyed the program. Because, listen, even being a strong Republican, here's the two things. On both sides of this is, number one, if we kick all the Mexicans or illegal aliens out of this country, a can of green beans is going to be $8. And the other side of the coin is I'm just tired... of people in our country, the way we take semantics and we twist things around. Trump is not saying Muslims. He's saying radical Islamic terrorists. We can't have them here, people. We can't. They can't be here.
All right, Marcella, you want to comment?
Well, first I would say that I have a lot of respect for Republicans, and I by no means see Republicans as uniformly anti-Latino or anti-immigrant. It's important to remember that Ronald Reagan is the one who passed the amnesty law in 1986, and that Orrin Hatch has been one of the people who has helped Republicans reach out to the Latino community. I think there are many Republicans, especially business-minded Republicans, who look at this with a bit of a clearer eye in terms of the role that undocumented immigrants play in many businesses. So I would certainly not want to be this to be a kind of partisan discussion. It has been turned into a partisan discussion.
Yes, it has.
In terms of the Reagan amnesty, one interesting thing about that is that one of the reasons why so many Hispanics became legal under Reagan's amnesty was because the agricultural lobby lobbied for certain exceptions for agricultural workers that was actually supposed to let many, many fewer undocumented people become legal. But the agricultural sector was tremendously worried about losing its workers, and they had the laws in that amnesty loosened for agricultural workers, and many of those workers were, of course, Hispanic. And so that was one of those things. I do think it's important as a journalist to distinguish between the administration's policies and its actions and the sort of rhetoric that can any candidate or any politician in office can make. It was important to do that with the Obama administration, where its rhetoric was very pro-immigrant.
Right.
Its actions, depending from your point of view, could be much less pro-immigrant, and I agree that it's important to continue to do that under the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Final comment, about a minute left. I think the fear of deportation is always there, this from Nicole, but the undocumented immigrants I know are more afraid now to leave their houses because of the increased harassment in the community.
Yeah, I definitely heard a lot about that. So I think that undocumented people have historically been afraid to go to the police when crimes are committed against them for fear of deportation. That's one of the reasons why so many police departments actually don't like 287G agreements or policies that want them to be involved in immigration controls, because they believe that to make our community safer, it's very important to build trust with all residents in order to find witnesses for crimes and people who will go to the police to tell them when crimes are committed. And now when undocumented immigrants or all immigrants really could be targeted by harassment,
mm-hmm.
that might be inflamed by some political talk, many of them are still even more afraid now than ever to go
mm-hmm.
and report the actions that are being
right.
against
yeah,
them or their children.
Good. Marcella, thank you very much. It's a great article. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to talk about it.
Marcella Valdez, contributing writer for the New York Times, also writes for the Washington Post, The Nation, and NPR. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. We're going to be talking about health care. What are the Republicans contemplating?